We can't have a kind of limitless neoliberalism, nor can we have a fully automated luxury communism. We actually need to have a different sort of narrative about what it means to be human, what it means to inhabit a landscape, what it means to embrace its limits.
You're listening to Damn the Absolute, a podcast about our relationship to ideas, produced by Eradicus. Here's your host, Jeffrey Howard.
Welcome, friends, philosophers, and fellow practitioners of ideas. This is episode 11 of Damn the Absolute. It wouldn't be unreasonable to say that we are always in an age of crisis. Whether this entails more apocalyptic tendencies or more tempered framings, crisis seems to be a constant companion throughout human history. At present, crises abound regarding climate change, exploitation of land, and soil degradation. We're seeing major cracks in political economies, many of which stem from misguided cultural paradigms. With an industrialized global economy based on fossil fuels and an ethos that disregards limits, we find ourselves in an unsustainable present with what is becoming an increasingly likely catastrophic future. Most people agree that we can't continue along the same trajectory we're currently on. Yet, many attempts to forestall further collapse of prevailing systems appear insufficient for the task at hand. What will it take to shift toward more egalitarian and low-carbon societies? Is it possible for global supply chains to be ecologically sustainable and ethically justifiable? What negative impacts do global and industrialized political economies have regarding personal autonomy, spiritual fulfillment, community connectedness, and ecological conviviality? When should we practice skepticism towards centralized and tech-optimist solutions to our many crises? Chris Smage is a farmer and social scientist that has co-worked a small farm in southwest England for more than 15 years. In his new book, A Small Farm Future, he argues that societies built around local economies, self-provisioning, agricultural diversity, and commoning of certain ecological resources are our best shot for creating a sustainable future in terms of the ecological, nutritional, and psychosocial. In this small farm future, Smage doesn't imply that there will be no place for large farms or industrialization. Similarly, he doesn't propose this vision as a panacea for all our problems, nor as a utopia looking backwards toward a romanticized past. There will be trade-offs, difficult ones. He offers a melioristic way forward, believing that ecological and moral limits are going to force our hand, compelling us to consider more radical alternatives than the status quo allows. A Small Farm Future advances a surprising amount of optimism, despite how much dominant systems are not only showing signs of significant breakdown, made more pronounced by the COVID pandemic, but suggesting their likely collapse. Whether or not the types of collapse Smage discusses actually happen in the ways he anticipates, he believes that the Earth's population will be better off if we shift toward smallholding property ownership, oriented around place-based communities and local economies. Several questions worth contemplating. In what ways does scaling up systems make us less able to deal with crises effectively? What advantages do permaculture and regenerative agriculture have over large-scale monocultural approaches? What are some politically feasible ways to make land access more egalitarian? And what trade-offs might we have to make in moving toward a small farm future? I hope you'll contribute to the conversation. Chris, welcome to the show.
Hi, Nerd. Great to be here.
We try and hold ourselves to a standard of trying to regularly challenge our own dogmas and creeds. What is a view you've held as an adult you were confident wouldn't change that has actually shifted dramatically?
Well, I guess when I was younger, my politics were very influenced by left-wing politics. So I was living quite a sort of urban life buying into the idea of sort of technological progress, not that interested in the countryside and gardening and farming. And I suppose in some ways, not at all drawn to sort of, the sort of conservative aspects of that, ideas about community and family and small property. And then bizarrely, I've sort of found myself writing a book, which in many ways I'm now living in the countryside on a small property with my family and other people, actually, but partly with my family. So I suppose in some ways, the thing that's changed is rethinking that a bit and being aware that some of these sort of feel good words like community and family, they are problematic. We need to question the way that they can be used and developed as a political project. And yet we need to think about them quite seriously as we contemplate some of the problems we're facing in the future.
Yeah, as someone myself who is very sympathetic to a lot of those values you just mentioned, I appreciate the willingness to look critically at them and acknowledging that there can be a dark side to each of them. Your book, A Small Farm Future, we're going to be talking about today. And in it, you mentioned the many crises we're facing as humans today. In brief terms, what does a small farm future look like?
Well, quick answer is I wish I knew. In some ways, it was really difficult writing a book about the future because you're bound to kind of end up being wrong in all sorts of fundamental ways. So I sort of tried to avoid any kind of blueprint about this is exactly what, listen to me, this is exactly how we have to do things. But because of the crises that you mentioned that we're facing, I'm pretty sure that the way that we're going to have to be doing things in the future are going to be pretty different from the way that many of us have been accustomed to in the past. And I think in particular, climate change is going to upend our world in many ways. I think we're going to have less easily available and abundant energy, less capital and money sort of flowing around than we're accustomed to, certainly in wealthy countries like the US or the UK where I live. So, and I think that's going to mean we're a little bit more rooted to locality and having to generate our livelihoods from the kind of local potential of the landscape. And so really, that's what, in a nutshell, that I think is what A Small Farm Future is going to be about. It's going to be about us as individuals and households and communities having to wrest a livelihood more locally in a lower energy and lower capitalized way.
You've already mentioned climate change. In the book, you mentioned 9 other crises we're facing. We're not going to be able to touch all of them, unfortunately, but I'd like to focus on a few of these. In what ways are we facing crises surrounding soil, water, and land?
Big issues globally with soil loss and soil degradation. I mean, some of the sort of mainstream ways in which we're farming on a big scale tend to be quite destructive of the soil or extractive of its nutrients. I mean, there's whole, you know, I'm not a soil scientist and there's whole big debates about this. You read these sort of things saying we only have 50 harvests left or whatever, and that's not necessarily true. But certainly soil is something that forms on geological timescales. And so we have to be super, super careful about how we farm to make sure that we don't degrade it. Going back to my small farm future shtick, one of the ways in which we can do that and preserve soil integrity and soil nutrients is by quite labor-intensive, small-scale, local husbandry of the soil. So that's one issue pushing towards a small farm future. And also something that I think, I mean, I certainly wasn't really aware of this until probably later than I should be. There are various nutrients that the plants that we rely on need. Nitrogen is a big one, but there's a kind of nitrogen cycle. There's nitrogen is abundant in the atmosphere. So one way or another, we can get it into our plants. But a lot of other things are less easily cycled. Phosphates is a big one that people talk about, and we tend to sort of mine those and apply them as synthetic fertilizer to our plants. And that, I think, is going to be a big issue in the future where we need to be thinking more in terms of cycles. So where is our waste going? Basically, human waste, often we're kind of flushing it down the toilet and into the sea. You know, that's not going to be sustainable in the long run. So again, that pushes towards more local cycling. So, yeah, a bunch of issues about the soil. Water was another one you mentioned, wasn't it? So big issues there with climate change and weather patterns. Obviously, a lot of places in the world, we've become used to stable weather patterns that kind of set the parameters for how we farm. That is already changing in many, many parts of the world with major, major droughts in some places, floods in others, questions about monsoon, glacial melt and so on. Irrigation is another big issue. I think something like 70% of the fresh water that humans use is used in agriculture, and we don't necessarily use that very efficiently or very sustainably. And sometimes we're sort of drawing on aquifers that are not sustainable in the long term. And also urbanization, getting water. When we concentrate into cities, the water infrastructure that we need to get water to people is very energy intensive, and in a lower energy future, I think that's going to be questionable. And yeah, so a lot of issues about water and land as well. I mean, land is basically where everything happens, you know. So huge debates about how should we be using land. And I mean, there's any number of things we could discuss there. I mean, I think one thing is we live in a very unequal world. So wealthy people have a lot of power to determine what happens on the land. And one way that manifests is in meat consumption. A lot of farmland globally is devoted to pasture for livestock, which, I mean, perhaps we can talk about that later, that livestock certainly have their role on small farms. But the way it works presently is that rich people get to eat meat, which is a land-intensive way of farming, if that's what we're sort of exclusively focusing on. And also biofuels. If we can't use fossil energy, well, perhaps we can use bioenergy. But that's another very land-intensive way of doing things. So without more economic and political equity, can end up in a situation where a small number of people get to determine what happens on most of the land, and most other people have less choice and can derive less benefit from the land. So again, part of the idea of a small farm future is that it's kind of inherently equalizing, that we need to individually and at a community level take our share to produce our livelihood, but not more than our share. So huge set of many other issues about land, but those are a few for sure.
As we're looking at these crises and climate change in particular, some people toss around concerns around population and advocate population control and telling people, stop having children. In what ways is that a good approach? In what ways might that be a very misguided answer to our many problems?
Well, it's funny, the whole sort of population debate, because I think pretty much everyone agrees on what we should and shouldn't do. What we should do is give people control, particularly women, control over their reproduction so that people don't have more kids than they want. I think that pretty much everyone agrees on that. In terms of population control as an environmental measure, I mean, it's problematic. I think partly populations are reducing anyway, whereas environmental impact isn't. And we've got to sort of move very, very quickly. So making sure that we keep population in check by good family planning and good female education and so on is a good thing to do anyway, but doesn't necessarily address the rapidity with which we need to address some of these issues. But also, I think we get into this slightly simplistic mathematics where we sort of have a per capita. We think in per capita terms that there's so much human impact on the planet, and then you divide that by the number of people on the planet. And therefore, obviously, the fewer people, the better for impact. Again, there's issues there about equity. I mean, as we all know, some people have a much bigger impact on the planet than others. But also, what's driving population increase and some of these impacts are more underlying sort of economic, cultural, technological issues. So, I mean, I talk about proximal and underlying causation in my book, that there's a danger that we focus on these kind of one-shot superficial solutions. Oh, it's population, or oh, it's we need nuclear power, or whatever it might be. That doesn't get at the kind of underlying generative factors. So part of the danger with the population debate is that numbers of people is the proximal factor, and we need to get at the underlying ones.
You're stepping a little bit more into the questions of culture, and culture is a crisis that you bring up in the book. What are some of the cultural answers or solutions that would lead us to a small farm future?
The 10 crises that you mentioned, that part of the book, I do try and sort of lead from kind of immediate factors like climate change or population that you just mentioned and try and put those into a deeper cultural framework, because ultimately our politics, our economics, our technology is culturally embedded. So we need to look at culture. I mean, I guess I frame it in terms of modernity, this whole notion that human, that there's a kind of arrow of history, that there's this kind of human progress, that we're sort of overcoming limits and that life is getting better and better. I'm not necessarily entirely critical of that. It's not all bad. And the idea of people having more agency and sort of individual control over life is not a bad thing. But we've sort of got into this slightly superficial sort of notion that it's kind of like the fully automated luxury communism sort of notion, that there's this upward trend that must be followed at all costs, that we have to get sort of more capitalized, more technology, more instrumental control. And so I think humans, we create these symbolic systems that kind of overrun natural ones very easily. And money is one. We've created this modern world in which a lot of us have got a lot of money in our pockets that has kind of real material consequences on the world, but we have very little capacity to restore the ecological systems that we're drawing down on. That kind of phosphate example I mentioned earlier would be one. It's great living in a city. You can go to the bathroom, flush the toilet, don't even need to think about that anymore. But there's a whole kind of energetic and material flow going on there that we need to address. And yeah, you know, some people say, well, you know, we've got the technology, we can nail this. Ultimately, I think we can't. You know, there's too many complex ramifying consequences to all that in a situation when we have to be decarbonizing, we have to be reducing energy use certainly in the wealthier countries. So I think all of that points to us spreading out really sort of in the landscape and learning to skim its flows rather than drawing down on it. So it's really about finding, you know, to go back to the cultural question, it's about finding a cultural orientation to what it means to be human, what it means to lead a good life that facilitates that.
When you're talking about culture here, you center around an embrace of limits and an acceptance of limits, which you contrast with a global capitalism or neoliberalism. Is it possible for there to be a neoliberal approach to a lot of these crises that embraces limits, or is that just very antithetical to the core of what global capitalism is about?
I don't think there is really. I mean, it's a curious one, and I'm not a philosopher. It kind of burns my brain a bit thinking about this whole sort of thing of limits, because the part of the original movement on the left was a kind of, it's almost like Foucault's biopower, putting people together into big units to overcome limits. As I was just saying, that there are some positive aspects of that. And it was almost like the conservative, the market thing was the opposite. It was like, no, we're talking bounded rationality, trading in local markets. You know, it's not about sort of breaking limits, but it's almost sort of been this inversion. I talk about it right at the start of my book, where neoliberalism has sort of been this breaking that open, the market, that it's no longer a kind of bounded local rationality. It's a sort of notion of marketizing everything. And I think it's no coincidence that there's all this talk of the space travel, Elon Musk sort of, it's like we sort of reached the limits of what we can do on the Earth. So now we need to go to Mars or start mining asteroids or whatever. And of course, there's a strand of the left that's bought into that, this idea that we need to sort of draw down more and more resources to spread it around so that everybody can lead a certain sort of unlimited life. And so, no, I think the answer is no. We can't have a kind of limitless neoliberalism, nor can we have a fully automated luxury communism. We actually need to have a different sort of narrative about what it means to be human, what it means to inhabit a landscape, what it means to embrace its limits. And of course, you know, one of the problems is that conservative thought has kind of, in some ways, drawn on the notion of limits to limit what people and particularly certain kinds of people can achieve. It's like it's natural for, there's a natural difference between men and women, say, so that, you know, men should do certain sorts of things and women should do others. So there is an understandable and necessary critique of the whole concept of nature and natural limits. But I think we've sort of thrown the baby out with the bathwater a little bit and pushed that critique too far. And what we need to do is kind of retain that critical edge in terms of we don't need to be limited as humans in certain sorts of ways, but ultimately we're animals. We need food, we need water, as do other animals. We're part of these cycles. So it's a kind of complex debate we need to have around that. But I think sort of suggesting that there are no limits is not a good way into that debate.
You've mentioned Elon Musk, who is a bit of an avatar for tech optimists. And I think of acquaintances who would read your book and respond with, well, he's a Luddite. He holds these overly romantic notions of agrarian society or localism. Why might that be a misrepresentation of your views?
Well, it's interesting you mention the Luddites, because I think they get a bit of a bad press. I suppose the way that's come down to us thinking about them is that it was just these people who were sort of atavistically smashing up technology, but really they had a political critique of the situation that they were in. It was they were being de-skilled, their labor was being removed by machines without any real political, the powers that be were not attending to, okay, that's fine, but then what are they going to do? And that's so much been the history of tech development, is just let technology sort of do its thing with no regard to the human consequences. So and that's what I think we need to have a slightly more mature attitude to technology. It's like, yeah, technology can be great, but what do we want from it? Do we want to go in this direction? What is human life all about? And that's where the sort of nostalgia thing, I recognize that critique, and I think I'm pretty careful in the book not to be romanticizing and idealizing small scale farm societies. I mean, I think the problem is we get into this very linear way of thinking about history, that the past was terrible and now is better and the future's going to be even better. And I think we need to sort of let go of that. It's not about saying, oh, you know, let's try and restore the situation as it was at any particular point in the past. In every human society, at every point in history, people are just trying to figure out the problems that they're facing at the time. And I guess if we can sort of let go of this notion that somehow we're better people than in the past, we're just people like other people were in the past, what can be valuable is saying, well, those people, they were confronted with a situation, a low capital, low energy situation. They had to figure out how to produce their livelihoods in situations which were pretty localized and pretty low energy compared to today, pretty low capital. I think we're going to have to be doing the same thing in the future. So it's worth looking at those societies, looking at how they organize themselves, what sort of problems did they have, how did they try and solve them, not to sort of mindlessly replicate everything exactly that they did, but just as kind of an act of humility. Well, they were in a situation that we now find themselves in. What can we learn from those societies? So it's pretty much in that spirit, I think. It's not about a sort of nostalgia or romance.
You take a amelioristic approach in your book, and as you just mentioned, you acknowledge that there are a lot of trade-offs that we make and will have to make if we shift toward a more small farm future. What would you say are two or three of the biggest and most difficult trade-offs that we'll have to make?
I'd say, well, kind of ones we've already touched on in a way. I mean, one is issues around social status. In a sort of modern urban setting, it's quite easy to walk away. If you don't like the social situation you're in, you can walk away, you can make some other friends, get another job, whatever. If you're more grounded in a local community, there are some good aspects to that, because one thing you certainly find now is this sort of thirst for more human connection and more community, which you can get in a small farm society. But at the same time, you have to get along with the same damn people, you know, day after day or through your life. It's harder to get away from people. And in that situation, it's very easy to get status hierarchies, very easy to get inequality. So that's something that we need to attend to very carefully. At the same time, I mean, talking of inequality, I think one of the narratives of sort of modernization and development is that here we are in the US or in the UK, it's rich countries. We've got all sorts of wonderful things we can do, food we can buy from all around the world. We can jump on a plane, whatever. Until recently, the narrative has been, well, if all the other countries can develop, then great, they can have access to that too. I mean, of course, we're slightly brushing aside the history of why some countries are more quote unquote developed than others in that narrative. That was a genuine, I think, sort of post-war people could sort of buy into that narrative. I don't think we can anymore. It's more and more apparent that that some people, a small number of people's wealth is at the expense of other people's misery. Those of us in the wealthier parts of the global distribution, I think a trade-off is we're going to have to get used to not being able to jump on a plane, not being able to have so much liquid capital to do some of the things we want. I think that there are some benefits of that, even to those of us who are wealthy, but it's going to be tough for some. And I guess the third one is a whole set of trade-offs around energy and labor and money and machinery. You sort of talked about Luddites. I'm not arguing that we should smash up all the machines and sort of revert to doing everything with a trowel, but we do need to have a debate about what kind of technology is feasible, what can we take forwards, how can we have a sort of good, modest agrarian life. But I think it's kind of easy to do that in a situation when energy is cheap, money is plentiful. That is a big trade-off that I think we'll have to confront.
You're someone who seems very interested in equality, egalitarian perspectives. Some people are going to look at your vision, the pro-agrarian localist vision, and express their concerns that historically agrarian societies have been patriarchal. There's been a lot of that type of domination in regards to gender dynamics. How do you accommodate or address those concerns?
I mean, that's a really huge issue that I touched it on it in my book, and I think it's something that we need to think through in much more detail. I mean, I think, and partly we have to do it because I think whether we like it or not, we, in view of the sorts of crises we're facing, we are moving towards societies probably where people are going to be more grounded locally in their households. And that means that we have to look very carefully at the kinds of relationships, that sort of intra-household relationships. On the one hand, you know, how we address that in policy terms is not necessarily that difficult. It's about people having options outside the household. It's about women being able to inherit land, for example, as in the same way as men. It's about, I mean, I argue in the book about the need to retain a public sphere where that we don't base the allocation of resources on notions, you know, as we were talking about a minute or two ago, we don't base them on sort of notions of natural and social status, male, female, sort of young, old, or any type of sort of class or ethnic distinctions, that we have a sphere of political debate that's open to all. I mean, it's an interesting one, you know, to what extent is an agrarian society inherently patriarchal? I mean, my sense of looking at the literature is that there are many different types of social organization historically and sort of cross-culturally in smaller scale subsistence oriented or small agrarian societies. So it's not necessarily that there is kind of a single gender dynamic that's determined by agriculture. That's something that I want to think and research and debate a bit more, but it's very important, I think, to hold on to that notion of the public sphere that I mentioned. I mean, the other thing I touch on in the book, again, historically, when people have had access to land or to money, Bina Agarwal has done really interesting work on this in South Asian context, or Andrew Linklater has written historically about property ownership. When a minority or an oppressed group has access to money, basically unlocks hierarchy to some extent. The difficulty is that I think whether we like it or not, we're facing a future where money and capital is going to be harder to come by. And to some extent, we need to keep a lid on it, because part of the problem we've got in is allowing the kind of symbolic abstraction of money to sort of run away with, you know, the relationship between our social systems and natural systems. So again, it's like it's a set of finely balanced trade-offs. I guess this is quite a long-winded way of saying, I don't know. I don't have the answers. You know, I can't write in a book, this is how we prevent gender hierarchies in the future. It's something, you know, that has to be attended to very carefully. And that's true. You know, whatever kind of system, patriarchy inserts itself in all systems in all ways. So it's not just about small farm societies, but I recognize the dangers of a local household-based societies. The potential for patriarchy presents itself in some quite well-established ways. And the sort of things I've mentioned hopefully will be ways we can ameliorate that. That is one of the big political struggles ahead for sure.
I suppose one way to view it is acknowledging there's not an inherent nature to a lot of these systems, that we take the learning we have in regards to some of these gender dynamics and hope and do our best to continue that learning forward, that in some ways society regresses and doesn't progress, and in other ways the reverse is true.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting when you look at my sense of different sort of historical agrarian societies, peasant societies, some of them have very stringent gendered divisions of labor, men's work and women's work. And, you know, we could debate the extent to which that inherently is patriarchal, but other societies, men and women do pretty much farm work is shared, or, you know, everyone pretty much is able to do all the jobs on the farm. I mean, on my farm, in my marriage, I suppose it's been a challenge to my sort of male ego, but I've realized over the years that my wife is much better than me at carpentry and building, whereas there's other sort of traditionally male things that I do, you know. So I think it's a matter of people need to work this out in their own households, but more importantly, sort of communities and in the wider society as we struggle with these issues and these crises to come.
Hello friends, Jeffrey here. Please go ahead, take a quick moment to click that subscribe button and rate us. It really helps us to further grow the community around Damn the Absolute. Enjoy the rest of the episode. You've mentioned in the future there's likely to be an increased difficulty in having access to capital, and there's already a lot of literature around the unequal distribution of capital. You are someone who is sympathetic to degrowth economics. What is degrowth economics, and what sense do you have for how mainstream it is becoming?
Well, I'm not necessarily the best person to give a cogent account of degrowth economics. I'd recommend listeners to take a look at Yorgos Kallis's, some of his writings, because certainly they've been informative for me. It sort of emerges out of a longer history of ecological economics, where the idea is, the sort of mainstream idea in economics is that we create more human welfare by having more resource throughput. So if we have more energy, more materials, that gives us more welfare, and it kind of creates more waste as well. But we're in a situation now where we can't have more energy, we can't have more capitalization, we can't have more metal and plastic and all the rest of it. So we need to generate, the aspiration to generate more human welfare is still there, but we need to do that with a lower throughput of energy and resources. And I think the implications of that are quite radical. You get the sort of decoupling argument that we can produce more steel or more fertilizer now than we could 50 years ago. We use less energy to create the same amount of product. And you know, that's true, but it's nothing like enough to get us out of the various predicaments we're in terms of climate change and energy and so on. So, I mean, I think degrowth economics to me is, again, partly it's about these issues of equality that we've been talking about. We need to spread the distribution more fairly. But it's also thinking in very different ways about the kind of lives that we lead. And that feeds into my kind of small farm future sort of stuff about skimming the flows, spreading out, being a denizen of the landscape, generating a good life. In many ways, it's a very attractive life, but we can't necessarily assume that we kind of have the throughput that we've been accustomed to historically. I think that is becoming more mainstream. The degrowth movement, people like Yorgos Kallis that I mentioned, or Jason Hickel, I think their work is becoming more mainstream and more well known. But it's still, I think, the sort of mainstream economic framework and the mainstream sort of tech framework that we just have to keep producing more and more and more energy, more materials, but kind of figure out how to absolutely decouple it from our drawdown on the planet is probably still the dominant one. And I think I, along with many of the degrowth folks, just find that implausible. Ultimately, we cannot absolutely decouple our way out of the crisis. Therefore, we need degrowth. And you get the sort of argument that, oh, degrowth is the same as a recession, but it's not. It's not about sort of continuing the mainstream growth paradigm and then it kind of taking a dive like it did in 2008 or like it has done with COVID. It's about a thorough reconfiguration. And that is sort of getting out there a bit more, but my fear is not enough, not fast enough.
to get a little bit more into the weeds or maybe grasses, there are globally three crops that we basically consume, fill up most of our diet. Why is that so worrisome?
Yeah, I mean, you're referring to wheat, rice, and maize, three cereal crops that provide an enormous amount of our nutrition. They're great crops. It's not entirely worrisome. You know, the reason that we grow them so widely is because they do a good job of feeding us. It's like the easiest way to produce the macronutrients, the energy and the protein that we need. The problem is partly the sort of ecological damage. They're all annual crops that require quite a lot of soil input, plowing, to put it simply, and they have high nutrient requirements. So there's a lot of labor and a lot of potential ecological degradation that goes into their cultivation. And partly, for sure, we need protein and energy, but I call it the arable corner in my book. We kind of box ourselves into this arable corner where, because it's so easy to produce this stuff, and partly this is connected to centralized states. These crops they're very transportable, they're very nutrient dense, they're very storable. So civilizations, the powers that be, have always loved these crops because you can urbanize, you can transport them. And so we end up in this situation where we produce far more of them than we really need. And partly it kind of feeds into this central state kind of centralization, urbanization narrative. And we can turn them into all these weird and wonderful things that you can buy in a store and, you know, open the packet and crunch it. But ultimately, it's not that great for our health. We need fresh fruit and vegetables. We need a more diverse diet. And it's not that great politically because it kind of feeds into centralization. And what we need to be doing is diversifying, spreading out, growing a wider range of crops. And yeah, for sure, still growing those crops, we need them, but not at the levels that we currently grow them.
Massive scale industrial agriculture goes hand in hand with these crops. You recommend regenerative agriculture and permaculture as more local alternatives. What are these two approaches and why are they better alternatives?
I do have my criticisms of both of those movements. I think whether it's in the mainstream food system with sort of GM crops and high-techery of various kinds, or in the alternative farming movement with things like regen ag or permaculture, we tend to go for this sort of magic bullet solutions like, oh, you know, regen ag has got all the answers. But essentially, regenerative agriculture is ultimately, it's about looking after the soil, which, as we were talking about earlier, is really critical on a kind of a more than human timescale. We've got to look after the soil. So it's about cover cropping and using the biological resources of the soil as much as possible to provide what we need. Again, there are trade-offs. I don't think it's quite as easy to do that and produce the level of food that we need as some advocates suggest. And that's why the answer to that, I think, is more small scale, more labor intensive agriculture. And that's perhaps where permaculture comes in. The idea, I mean, any number of things we could talk about there, but in a nutshell, I think the idea is about designing yourself as an individual or as a household or as a community into a productive and sustainable landscape. So it goes back perhaps to that limits part of our discussion. It's about emplacing yourself in the ecology and drawing from it to create your livelihood, but not mining it. And so those are in some ways movements that speak to that. Yeah, we need to sort of take seriously those messages. Yeah, you know, in many ways, you can produce more. There's a whole kind of debate about economies of scale and so on. In many ways, you can actually produce more per unit of land on small scale, diverse, regenerative forms of agriculture than you can in big scale agriculture. But it's labor intensive, of course. So that's the issue with it. And that's kind of my argument, that that's what we need to embrace rather than shy away from.
Part of your project is to, as you put it, rewild the environment as well as rewilding ourselves. What do you have in mind with this?
Well, in some ways, I suppose it's kind of what I was just referring to. I think there's a whole movement about rewilding, about embracing the nature, and depending on where you are, I would broadly speaking embrace that. But again, there can be a trade-off between leaving land to nature and producing the food that we need from it. But I think an aspect of rewilding ourselves, I suppose I touch on in the book, is kind of a different mindset to that one of progress, of sort of fully automated luxury that we were talking about earlier. I think of rewilding the self as, like all organisms, we're born with capacity to thrive and to create a livelihood from the environment that we find ourselves in. And so rewilding ourselves is kind of doing that, but knowing when to stop. All organisms kind of know how to fill their larder, but perhaps part of the problem that we've got into is that we don't know when to stop filling our larder, either our sort of actual or our figurative larder. You know, there's a whole narrative around sort of more and more and better and better. And so rewilding ourselves, I think, partly is about knowing when to stop. And it's a funny one because people talk about the luxuries and the pleasures of modernity and not wanting to go back to a hard life. But in many ways, there's various different dimensions of why life in the in small farm societies of the past was so hard. But in many ways, we embrace having an objective resistance. We kind of do the people sort of climb Mount Everest or put themselves through all sorts of crazy rigors in order to sort of feel fully alive. And I suppose that, again, is part of what rewilding ourselves is. We can't necessarily all climb Everest, but we can attend to producing a livelihood, working to some extent with and to some extent against the natural world around us. And that is being a wild creature, that is living, that is creating meaning and creating livelihood.
You're starting to go down this path, so I want to raise this question. Your vision requires a lot of labor. It's a very labor-intensive approach to a lifestyle. And agrarian lifestyles, because of the hard work that is endemic to them, may not appeal to a lot of people, but you suggest that it lends itself to a lot of human flourishing. Someone who's skeptical of your vision, in what ways would you say a small farm future lends itself so well to human flourishing?
It's partly the sort of things I was talking about. It's making a livelihood. It's having agency, having some autonomy, but within a wider community. It's that balancing individual or household agency and competence with being part of a wider community. And as I say, you know, encountering, it's like a real encounter with the world, kind of like if you climb Everest, part of the idea is that it's difficult and you might not succeed. The sort of modernization narrative that we were talking about earlier, I think, kind of goes a little too large on the notion of ease, because it's not actually what people want. You know, people want challenge and to have some sort of agency. I mean, it's kind of interesting. I draw on some psychological work that I came across in my book, where people kind of say that they want leisure, but research sometimes finds that actually people are not particularly happy. When you're at home watching Netflix, you're supposed to be happy, but you're not. And it's when you're at work, working on projects with other people, trying to achieve something sort of meaningful and tangible, that's when people are often happiest. And so if we get it right, and I'm not saying it's easy to get it right, but if we get it right, that can be something that's delivered by small-scale local agrarianism, a kind of real agency, real livelihood making within a community locally.
Brings to mind, I think, of the contrast between getting together with a group of friends and just being in the same space and hanging out and the bonding that happens there versus the bonding and the community that comes from working on something together, building something together. And there's a stark contrast, I think. There's a place for both, but I think there's a certain depth and meaning that comes from the latter that you don't get in the former.
Right, yeah. And it's interesting. I mean, I've written about this a fair bit in terms of commoning, that the sort of people's, you know, you were talking earlier about the sort of romantic idea of small farm societies. But when you look at the sort of history of a lot of agrarian societies, they're actually quite unromantic in terms of figuring out closely in detail how people will work with each other. And sometimes nowadays, I think we get into this slightly romantic mindset, either about how things were in the past or about how we're going to get out of the present problems we're in by this sort of notion that we're all going to work together. It's all going to be this nice community. We were talking about some of the problems with feel-good words like community earlier. When you look at the way that agricultural commons were designed historically, they attended very carefully, certainly to the fact that people had to work with each other, and that generated welfare and generated benefit, but also it generated conflict, and sort of human conflict is inevitable. So part of it is also about being unromantic and being serious about the limits of working together. But like you say, when people are working on a project, it kind of throws up real problems, real things that you have to solve, rather than just sort of having a nice time or a nice walk in the country or whatever it might be, you know.
One of the biggest challenges that I see with moving toward a small farm future is the fact that there are hundreds of millions of people globally who don't really have access to land, that people that aren't small holding landowners. What might be a politically feasible way to make land access more egalitarian in the US or the UK?
Right. Well, I mean, there's all sorts of policy instruments that I can reel out, which are quite simple, sort of inheritance taxes, gift taxes, zoning laws, or whatever. The issue is, or the stumbling block is your word feasible, you know, because that's not within our sort of contemporary political discourse. So I think we can work on those ideas. We need to work on those ideas, but to some degree, we need to build bottom up. I mean, I'm here in the UK. I'm part of an organization called the Ecological Land Cooperative, which is essentially raising money through various means to buy agricultural land and then settle people and clusters of small holdings. I mean, in the US, I did a webinar a couple of weeks back with Leah Penniman, who's written this wonderful book, Farming While Black, where she talks about the African-American experience of farming in US history and trying to sort of build capacity in African-American communities today. And because of the racism and kind of historic structural disadvantage of Black communities in the States, they developed ways of pooling resources. Community land trusts kind of emerged out of that experience. So again, I think people with money, or even people without money, but who sort of feel the need to create more community access to farming, need to pool the resources. The question is, it's not just about pooling the resources, it's then about how we actually settle the land, how we sort of create those kind of households or commoning arrangements. But I think I'm not convinced it's going to come from the political center. So part of what I talk about in the later part of my book is the fact that I think this is going to emerge out of crisis. It is going to emerge out of the fact that states are increasingly unable to deliver the kind of services and welfare that people need. So we are going to have to sort of take it upon ourselves. But that has to start now. And I think the best way is by people kind of attending to the where they get their food from, attending to food issues in their local communities and trying to build that capacity themselves, because it's not really going to be done for us.
What are just a few first steps you would recommend for somebody who wants to shift their household or help encourage their community to shift toward a small farm future?
Well, good question. I think individually or within a household, there's kind of a continuum between doing absolutely nothing at all and spending your entire life producing food. So basically, I would suggest trying to shift yourself just one feasible step along that continuum. So if you do nothing, maybe you could grow some herbs on a windowsill.
That's unfeasible.
We get into these debates about who is a farmer, and I sort of say, you know, someone who's growing some herbs on the windowsill is a farmer. That's where it starts. Build up from there. Start growing in a garden. If you don't have a garden, get together with people in your community, identify potential spaces in your community where you can grow collectively, but also attend to the kind of food provision in your community and start asking questions about where does it come from? What can we do to improve resilience? Unfortunately, I think ultimately the structural changes are going to have to be vast, and in many places they're going to be quite chaotic. But the more that we can attend to that now in our communities, the easier the transition will be. And I think probably I got a bit hung up when I switched into farming in terms of making it work as a business, but ultimately farming doesn't work as a business. And that's not only on small scales, on big scales. Most farmers globally, the whole way that farm economics works is basically a disaster, and it's a kind of a race to the bottom where everyone's competing with each other and nobody's making any money out of actually producing food. So as far as you can, try and insulate yourself from the mainstream market. It's not about money. It's about community. It's about connecting with people. It's about connecting with people through food. That's easier said than done. But that, I think, is what the way that we need to be thinking about this.
Chris, I think you put forward a satisfying blend of doom and hope and practicality at the same time. So thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you for listening to Damn the Absolute. I hope you found our conversation worthwhile. We would love it if you could leave us a review wherever you listen to podcasts, whether that is Stitcher, iTunes, CastBox, or one of the many other options available to you. It goes a long way in helping us to build a community committed to fruitful ideas. See you next time.